around at the homeless, look around at the people without health care, look around at the people that are losing money, they're getting evicted, et cetera, the people that can't hold on, people living paycheck to paycheck, like myself and my family. But anyway, they say, look, there may be some hesitancy by landlords to engage with the city on some sort of lame subsidy program. It's called the LINC program. You know, I mean, they don't even talk about, hey, let's just declare an emergency, tear down, take under eminent domain those abandoned buildings in neighborhood X, because there are always some. Take them under eminent domain, tear them down, and build another 500, you know, free housing units run by the city just to get homeless people and their families. We'll start with families off the street, you know, and multiply that in every borough in New York and go outside the city, do what you have to do. It has to be an emergency. It has to be, and get the money from the federal government, cut the military budget by 0.1% to get the money, and you'll have all the money you need. Anyway, as the Coalition for the Homeless points out, while the number of sheltered individuals in New York City is at its highest level since the 1930s, there are thousands of unsheltered homeless people who are also sleeping in public spaces each night, making it impossible to tally exactly how many New Yorkers are actually homeless. And I'm looking at this chart. I mean, it's sickening. The spike in homelessness started around really bad around 2012, just enormously jumped up to around, here you go, here's the stat, 60,000 in the shelter system every night. 60,000 right now. That's only in the shelter system. So what are we looking at? Maybe 90,000 homeless or something like that in New York every night? That's the size of a big city, you know, relatively big city. Again, highest levels of homelessness since the Great Depression of the 30s. Research shows the primary... Oh, this is... All right, I'm not even getting into this. Research shows the primary cause of homelessness, particularly among families, is lack of affordable housing. Wow, okay. Well, let's say it's capitalism, okay? Because that's the truth. It's not... Where does the lack of affordable housing come from? Capitalism. No one is going to build anything unless forced to by a mass movement, and there have been some good ones. Nobody's going to build any housing. Nobody's going to have rent control or subsidies or any of that horrible, horrible stuff, according to the corporate media, unless they're forced to. So the de facto overwhelming house building is for profit. People don't have enough money for the owners of the buildings and the landlords to get the profit rate they want. So they will leave them empty. They will rent only to those that can afford it. And of course, you know, what's the story? What's the background story of if you're reporting, if you're showing 60,000, 90,000 people homeless on the street of New York every night? How many people are on the verge of homelessness? How many people are spending 75% of their income to stay in an overcrowded apartment, to have a room in an overcrowded apartment, you know? It's like that Lou Reed song. I miss Lou Reed in a lot of ways. I mean, he wasn't a ubiquitous, he wasn't a big presence in the media, but every time I'd check in, there'd be a new quote or a new something, a new song by Lou Reed that would cut right through the crap usually, you know? So he's got that song, I can't remember the name of it, but he's basically, the line in it is, and you know, he describes this Latino family living in New York, in a neighborhood in New York, and he goes, somewhere a landlord is laughing till he wets his pants or something like that, you know? I mean, there's that 1% that Occupy talked about and that people still talk about, that 1% has, I don't know, let's say a good percentage of that 1% of extremely evil people, I can't say the words on the air, that are laughing all the way to the bank. They are wallowing in venal piles of money. Again, there's pauses because there's so many words that come into my mind that I can't use. While they step over the homeless people, or more accurately, have their driver drive through the streets where they won't see the homeless people. Each night, the article does admit that each night, thousands of unsheltered homeless people sleep on the New York City streets and the subway system and other public spaces. There's no accurate measurement, they admit, of the New York City's unsheltered homeless population. And recent city surveys significantly underestimate the number of unsheltered homeless New Yorkers. So the 60,000 is a severe underestimate. African-American, Latino New Yorkers are disproportionately affected by homelessness. Approximately 58% of the New York City homeless shelter residents are African-American. Can you imagine that? What? That's racism right there. That's racism right there. You know, in concrete figures, 58% of New York City's homeless shelter residents are African-American. compared to the, oh, this is ridiculous. 31% are Latino, 7% are white, less than 1% are Asian American, and 3% are of unknown race and ethnicity. And all of them, regardless of race and ethnicity, have no, there's no reason they should be on the street. It's insane. Meanwhile, the number of homeless families, can you imagine, has also nearly doubled since 2006. There we got a nice little chart about homeless families, up to 16,000 as of September 2016. They have number of homeless people each night, separated by the number of children, 24,000. Almost, they've got adults in families, 15,000. They've got single adults, 24,000. And de Blasio, in 2016 Mayor's Management Report, he's saying there's a 42% increase in applications for emergency rent assistance from New York City families at risk of losing their housing. That's what I was trying to say earlier, that when you read a statistic anywhere, you could have this in Boston, where there's this huge influx, huge increase in the number of homeless, then you have to think there's also an increase in the number of near homeless. There's an increase in the number of people under severe stress of possibly being evicted, of getting into that realm. I don't want to bring this down to personal anecdote, because that's, Americans wallow in that way too much and forget, don't see the systematic problems. But I've been there. I've been in a situation where I saw it coming, couldn't stop it, ended up couch surfing, was never totally on the street in terms of all night, but ended up couch surfing. Know a lot of other people doing that now. A lot of millennials are doing that kind of stuff now. So-called millennials. I don't really like that term, but I'm just stuck with it, I guess. Now I can see, a path. When you're living paycheck to paycheck, you can see certain scenarios that end up in, oh, you lose the house. Oh, you lose the apartment. Oh, boom, boom, boom. You know, this is, it's seeing that coming down the line possibly, or seeing it coming down the line probably, creates an incredible precariousness to your life here in the United States. You can talk about the precariat now. That's usually talked about in terms of jobs, but let's talk about it in terms of the offshoot of you lose a job, boom, 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 right? That you could fall down into this pool of homelessness and complete poverty pretty, pretty quick. Or you keep the job, but it just doesn't pay enough, which happens all the time now. And you start losing your home. All the so-called choices under capitalism get narrower and narrower and narrower. I mean, you know, all the fees that you have to pay to have your kids involved in something, all the entrance fees to just do anything culturally now, these are prohibitive. You know, these are prohibitive. The dental fee, you know, the dentist, the next dentist I run into, I'm just going to really give them a talking to, because listen, dental care has to be nationalized and made public, and same with eye care. This is an enormous burden on working people now. In America, basic dental and eye care is an enormous financial burden. Has to be changed, et cetera. And here we go. And then at the end, so I get the idea this might be some sort of left-wing publication, but I didn't check it out. Zero Hedge, again. At the end of this article, they say, if this is what a, quote, recovery, unquote, looks like to Obama, we would certainly like to better understand how he would define a recession. And we could ask that same thing of Hillary Clinton. Anyway, I think we have not had a show since the Harvard dining hall workers won their strike. And I am switching gears here. No segue. I'm going into a struggle that impacts everything we just talked about. The ability to afford a home, an apartment, anything. Fees for your children, dental care for your children, etc. There's some workers that fought back. 750 dining hall workers at Harvard University, the richest university in the world, that tried to starve them back to work without a decent contract. Well, they didn't get starved back to work. They got a decent contract. They got a really good contract, actually. And we talked about it on the show before, but they basically went out in early October. They went out because Harvard, the richest university in the world, came at them with health care concessions, pay more for your health care, came at them with the same old in terms of low pay. They have this particular situation where a lot of them don't work over summers and holidays, and Harvard didn't want to do anything about that except for a token little bit on that. And overall, it was going to be a concessionary contract for these 750 workers. They were going to lose more ground in terms of living standards and so on. And then Harvard put out things like, well, you know, on average, they make $21 an hour, blah, 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 you know. Well, think about average Harvard. Think about average versus median. Think about how every corporation, including Harvard, exaggerates when you go on strike. They exaggerate how much money you make because they want people to turn against each other. Oh, I don't make that, so why should they? Well, if you help them make more, you will make more. That's the, but a lot of Americans don't understand that. It's a real race to the bottom mentality among a lot of working people here. Maybe that's changing because the Harvard workers, dining hall workers that are in Unite Here Local 26, they actually showed a really good alternative to the race to the bottom, which is if you fight, you can win. And they did win. They won a $35,000 minimum wage for everybody, all the workers. It might only be the full-time workers, but I think a lot of them do work full-time here still. But not full-time in terms of all year round. And for that problem, they won more money for their summer, for the times when they're not in work. They won, they stopped the healthcare concession entirely. And for a five-year contract, they got 22% in raises. Now, they also got retroactive pay back to the beginning of the strike. They got some of the strike expenses they had during the striking time paid for. But still, you know, it hurt some workers. I've heard, you know, they missed that rent payment, or they had to go all that for that almost a month out. They had to go dip into savings, and or they're living on the edge, and they had to do certain things. And it's not like everything is all perfect again. It never was, but it's not like everything is perfect. And there could have been, you know, it could have been higher wage increases. There could have been more jobs offered over the summer and holidays. But basically, the union leadership and the workers were able to mobilize enough. They did mobilize a lot of their members to go out, and they stopped the health care concessions, at least for the next 5 years. They got the $35,000 salary minimum per year. They got the 22% wage increase, and they got the increased money for over the summers and holidays. And they got these other things that a lot of people haven't heard about. They got a diversity committee set up. They got the retroactive pay and some of the costs of being on strike taken care of. So the starving them back to work did not work by Harvard. And if you were in this area where this struggle was making, in the Boston area, where this struggle was making some headlines, so getting some coverage, it was to me, it was completely hilarious and evil at the same time that after the strike ended, National Propaganda Radio put like a 3 or 4 minute segment together about how, well, Harvard really isn't that rich. Endowments are earmarked and blah, 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 you know. And I'm going to get back to that in a second. But just, you know, there was a lot that led to the victory of the strike. There was solidarity from other unions. Teamsters Local 25 refused to deliver food. Construction workers, IBW Local 103, had some work stoppages. Union members on their own from my union, although the union did ask people to go to the picket line at a certain point, mostly people mobilizing themselves from the Harvard Union clerical and technical workers, went out and went out to the pickets. Mass Nurse Association, there's Cambridge City Hospital down the road, and members of Socialist Alternative that are that were in the Nurses Union, that are in the Clerical Workers Union, like myself, and Socialist Students and members of Social Alternative from Northeastern and from UMass and so on went out to the picket line. And at Harvard itself, there's a Student Labor Action Movement group, SLAM, it's called, and they came out of the fairly successful and very, very important living wage sit-in back in 2000 at Harvard. They've managed to stay together since then, and they are now doing a very good job. I think they did a very, very good job at getting student support for the strikers and for doing solidarity. So, and I'll quote directly from something they put out in the middle of the strike. They said, "Harvard is choosing money over people." This is from SLAM at Harvard. "At the first walkout, 500 students left class in support of dining hall workers, but apparently this wasn't enough for Harvard to make the right choice to end the strike. It's essential to demonstrate how much we support HUDs, that's Harvard University Dining Service Workers, HUDs, workers. 3,088 students have signed the petition, but it won't make any difference if we don't convert our support into action and make Harvard end the strike now." And they actually, the students were the core, 250 students were the core of a short occupation, a short sit-in in the lobby of a Harvard building the last night of negotiations. And I think that was extremely important. They were joined by workers and others. They did break it up at a certain point, but it was there for hours. And believe me, at Harvard, I know this from being involved in the living wage sit-in. I didn't sit in, but I was involved in it to a certain extent. That was very successful in a lot of ways, and it scared Harvard down to its marrow, down to its money marrow. And they got any kind of occupation tactic, which this union did end up doing a little bit here, scares Harvard to death. And by the way, occupation tactics don't stem from the Occupy movement. They stem from way back in American history, including a huge use of that tactic. I don't think it's the beginning of the tactic, but because it's kind of like a common sense thing in some struggles, but a big use of occupation, or what used to be called sit-in, came from the strike movement, a strike wave in the building of the CIO in the United States in the 1930s, specifically 1936-37, where workers in the big auto plants and so on would sit in to get union recognition, to get contracts settled, to stop layoffs. And these were huge, huge strikes and spread to way beyond the auto industry, even into white collar, into retail. I don't know about white collar. I'd imagine so, but I don't have any proof of that. Retail, things like Woolworths and so on, sit-down strikes, occupations, these hurt the capitalists really bad, because it's like if you're on strike and you're outside the workplace, they can try to keep you out, starve you out till you're ready to cave and go back in if they let you go back in, right? So that leaves the bosses in control of their property, right? What they call their property. It's really social property, but they call it their property, right? Now, say you occupy. Say you sit down, right? Or occupy. Well, I like that one better. Then you're controlling their property. You're controlling their means of producing, and you stop production because you're not adding your labor to the productive process, which is key. So nothing's getting made. And to come in and get you out, that might damage the property. That might damage the machinery, the desks, whatever, you know. They don't like that. They don't want to lose that, you know. And it's also going to be violent. I mean, there was a sit-in fairly recently, 2012, at Chicago Windows and Doors, right? This is a factory that made windows and doors. Company squandered a bunch of money, said they're going to lay everybody off and blah, blah. The workers just said, no. And they occupied, mostly Latino workers in this part of Chicago. They occupied. They won. I don't know what the situation is there now, but they won, and the last time I checked into it, they were still, the factory was still running, and they had a strong union there. It was my old union, electrical workers, one of my old unions. And that's, so Occupy is a huge tactic, and unions have to use it. I mean, and hopefully this victory by the Harvard workers, where they used all sorts of tactics, they used direct action, they got some of the leaders got arrested sitting in the middle of the road, Mass Ave in Harvard Square. They used a little bit of Occupy towards the end. They had the students walk out of class. They had mass picket lines, mass rallies. They used a lot of tactics, and most importantly, they got a lot of their members mobilized in the strike. And they ended up with a clear victory, in my opinion. And we're hoping that this victory will energize other unions. You know, in Boston right now, the subway workers are under severe attack. There should be a mass solidarity for them, for their struggle against privatization. There are workers, I believe Local 26 is going to maybe have a struggle at Northeastern. Maybe it's been settled. There's a struggle opening up at Harvard. I think it's still going on with janitors. Tufts University right here, where this radio station emanates from. The workers settled a contract after this strike was settled. So I'm thinking it has had a knock-on effect, but I'm hoping it has a knock-on effect in a more profound way with organizing, retail work, you know, dining hall workers, food service workers, seeing the need to join the union, to do more organizing, to win a union as well, and win those kind of gains that they won at Harvard, but also in terms of existing unions, using more creative tactics, mobilizing more of the members, having more solidarity. I mean, I'm not blaming anyone involved in this strike, but I'm saying in general, the labor movement should have rallied to the defense of the strikers much, even more than they did. I mean, there was some good solidarity. There should have been more. There should have been solidarity strikes. There should have been unions bringing in a lot more to bear on Harvard, which is, you know, one of the top five. It used to be number two number two employer in Massachusetts. I heard it dropped to like five or something recently. These are not the jobs of the Harvard workers per se. They are and they aren't. That's a dialectic of having a job. Basically, the jobs are also the jobs, the people's jobs. You know, they're the upcoming generations. And a place like Harvard, until we someday hopefully get it under public ownership, it is this huge privately owned big corporation. Forget the nonprofits. That's just a tax job dodge. And we need to have people, we need to have those jobs be living wage jobs. And they're not quite there yet, actually. In the context of the Boston move, Boston area, this was a union, this was a victory, right? This was a victory for Local 26, for the workers, for working people in general, I would say, in the area and beyond. And yet, if we're really hardcore about it, we have to be, because people's lives are at stake. We're not yet at a living wage for most of those workers. You know, it's a big step forward. Don't mean this as a criticism. I just mean this as an objective fact. And I think a lot of the workers would agree that actually, in the context of Boston and this inflated living standards here, inflated costs, I'm sorry, of living here, then you need actually more than what was gained in this strike. And I agree with that. I totally agree with that. I'm living it. I agree with that. Anyway, yeah, let's talk about the elections. As the corporate media is saying, oh, it's the last weekend of the elections, blah, 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 blah. And isn't that great? We don't have to talk about it anymore. Well, believe it or not, warts and all, with all the crap you have to listen to from Trump and Clinton, and all the horribleness of these people, of Trump and Clinton, it's still a time where, like, people are talking a little bit about things they should be talking about. Not the politicians. Their campaigns are very superficial. But in terms of people on the street, discussion about the elections can lead to a discussion about deeper politics. When the elections are over, what do you hook your discussion on? Well, maybe an issue that's a single issue thing, but then they say, oh, that's going to affect me or something. You know what I mean? Like, there's a general political discussion happening now. However childish in the United States, however infantile it is in the United States, it's still there. And I mean infantile because of the lack of an alternative political party on a mass scale, of a workers' party of some sort. But it's still there. So, you know, in Social Alternative, we've been promoting and calling for a vote for the Stein-Baraka campaign. And I just want to get into that a little bit, because a lot of people still haven't voted yet. And Social Alternative is calling for a vote for Stein-Baraka. And some of the things they stand for, Stein-Baraka, cancel student debt, to free a generation from indentured servitude to Wall Street, guarantee tuition-free public higher education. Now, I'm reading from a pamphlet I got, or a leaflet I got in Central Square, Cambridge. Pretty good. 43 million strong Americans with student debt can decide the 2016 presidency. Because it's clearly gauged at students, but I think there's a lot of good stuff in here for everybody. And institutional racism in policing, courts, prisons, education, health, and unemployment. Now, it doesn't say this here, but when you step back and look at how Stein and Barack have campaigned, there are criticisms you can have, and we've got a lot in Social Alternative, but Stein is the only candidate that went out on a march with Black Lives Matter, the only candidate that went to the DAPL and the anti-DAPL, anti-pipeline protests out in North Dakota. And, you know, the Green Party does not do enough campaigning in between elections, but at least in the election time, Stein-Baraka did get out to some of the movements that are out there that were happening despite the elections, the diversion of the elections in some ways. End the war on drugs, to stop the violent underground drug economy, improve public safety, create new jobs, generate revenue for our communities, legalize marijuana and hemp, guarantee living wage jobs for every American who needs work with a Green New Deal, creating 20 million jobs in green energy, sustainable agriculture, public transportation, and economic restoration. And just on that one, you know, this is what would happen if you had a true mass left alternative in this political, election, for example. Say there was a workers' party out there and running a candidate. I mean, I'm fairly confident that the term jobs program would not be off the table the way it is. I mean, I don't even remember Sanders talking about it, but it's probably buried there in his program somewhere. I mean, I would be out there every day. Jobs program, every city you go into, every rural area you go into, it'd be like the WPA on steroids, meaning the old Roosevelt thing, with real union wages and benefits. This is something Social Alternative stands for, real union wages and benefits, jobs program to build and rebuild the infrastructure, to build low-income housing, to do all the kind of work there is out there. I mean, pick up the litter. I mean, the streets are filthy in most American cities. All the kind of jobs that used to exist, right, in many places to that were public sector jobs, they've been cut drastically. And you can see it palpably if you've lived long enough. I mean, if you're just getting in, if you're just, you know, 18 years old and noticing the condition of the city around, you might think it's normal that there's trash everywhere, you know, and that things look pretty ugly in most places. And there's nothing that says it has to be that way. You know, renovation of public housing, renovation of streets and so on, all these things could be jobs programs. Think of all the jobs programs that were during the WPA. Think of what Green New Deal means, right? Jobs program where you could be building public transportation drastically needed in every city, where you could be building alternative energy sources, solar, wind, geothermal, all sorts of stuff. And then they go on to, you know, a lot of other demands here that are quite good. And like I said earlier, they're not afraid to bring up end wars for oil, create a foreign policy based on diplomacy, international law, and human rights, slash military spending, end drone attacks, support U.S. support for human rights, stop U.S. support for human rights abusers, enact Medicare for all, in other words, single payer or something like that, to provide high quality health care as a human right. This is the Stein-Baracus, just some of the demands they put forward. And if you vote for Stein-Baracus, you're voting for that program. But you're also voting to say, no, the corporate politics of the Democrats, Republicans don't speak for me. Here you go. This is more what I think is in the right direction. Vote for Stein-Baracus. People then see that and they're like, oh, a lot of people voted for that. Wow, that's interesting. I should take a look at it too. And through voting, through promoting the campaign, getting involved, whatever, I'll be standing out on election day with a Stein-Baracus sign. Hopefully I'll meet people and I'll say, hey, look, after the election, let's get together. Let's our organizations get together. Hopefully Socialist Alternative will get together with people and groups that want to continue this fight for a workers' party, for a real political alternative, a progressive mass left party that would not get its money from big business. When Shama Sawant, again, back to that example on the local level, Social Alternative ran Shama Sawant, open socialist, member of Social Alternative, without a penny of corporate money, ran and won election and re-election. Now, there are some ballot questions here in a lot of states, obviously, but here in Massachusetts. And I want to talk about a couple of them. Question two, which is a question on lifting a cap of what they call charter schools, allowing more publicly funded but privately run schools to happen in Massachusetts. There's already a proliferation of those, unfortunately, and there's tons of money coming in from the richest people in the country coming in and trying to do in this state like they've done in other states, pushing a privatization of education. They want to make money off education in ways that they currently can't. And they want to bust unions and so on, and it's really horrible. And they're spending so much money, and the capitalist governor of Massachusetts is shilling for this. He's putting this forward, and it's a complete conflict of interest. He's going to gain profits from this indirectly, and there's all sorts of horror shows happening around the country with ballot questions, I'm sure, but this one in Massachusetts. If they lift the charter cap, it's going to be for like every year. They're going to be able to bring in more of these private schools using our tax money to fund without the same rules the public schools have. I'm looking right at a thing I got from the Massachusetts AFL-CIO. Quote, Massachusetts is underfunding public education by at least $1 billion each year. Let's be real about investing in education beyond fully funding our public school system. Increasing access to preschool and early learning programs for every child, expanding enrichment programs like art, music, and athletics, creating more opportunities for STEM education. We don't need Wall Street billionaires telling us how to run our schools. The out-of-state groups behind lifting the charter school cap are backed by Wall Street billionaires who want more charter schools that are run by for-profit companies. That's from the Annenberg Institute for Social Reform, as quoted in the Boston Globe, that last quote. They say this year alone, charter schools will drain more than $400 million that would otherwise stay in neighborhood public schools to help all students. More charters could jeopardize local resources for other important political public services like police, fire, and public works. That's from the Massachusetts Municipal Association. Charter schools are not accountable to local communities. The state often approves them over the opposition of local parents and taxpayers. That's wrong. Communities should have the final say on what kind of schools they want. That's from Save Our Public Schools fact sheet. Pushing for publicly funded, privately run schools is a form of union busting. It's a form of union busting, right out of the same playbook that seeks to privatize public services and slash workers' rights. That's even the New York Times says that from 5215. So go to www.saveourpublicschoolsma.com. www.saveourpublicschoolsma.com. All one, smushed together into one word. Save Our Public Schools. MA for Massachusetts.com. Educators know that question two will take millions of dollars away from successful local district public schools and cause the elimination of music and art programs, increased class sizes, and other damaging cuts in the schools that most families choose. There's a growing list of organizations who have voted to oppose question two, over 175 school committees, the Massachusetts Parent Teacher Association, Massachusetts Elementary School Principal Association. No on two, bad for schools. Of course, the Mass Teacher Association is very much against that. And I would urge all our listeners to not only vote no on two, but get everyone else you can to vote no on two, because it is another step towards the complete privatization of education. It's more corporate welfare, hands out to the handing out more money and power to the super rich. And you're being played for a fool, you know. Nobody, even the MTA and the Massachusetts AFL-CIO Federation, doesn't talk about how easily we could fund public schools freely for everyone from K through 12, K through college, actually, by having the federal government pay for public schools. It's ridiculous. This property tax system is insane. It creates enormous inequalities. And so the answer for big business is not to erase inequality. It's to create more inequality. They make charter schools seem like, oh, more choice, more chance. It's a lottery, man. It's a lottery. And if they were all charter schools, they would find ways to price people out of the system, just like they do with everything else, when they control healthcare or whatever. Don't be fooled. Be smart. Vote no on two. Then there's question four, which is on pot. And marijuana, legalizing it to a certain extent with a lot of qualifiers. And, I'll be honest, from an individual point of view, this is not the position of Social Alternative individually. The last thing we need is more people, walking around kind of stoned or whatever. We need people alive, alert, in the struggle for socialism, But on the other hand, just a ton of people, of course, a ton of people I know, they use pot on a regular basis. And, the argument that it's not as bad as alcohol seems to, make some sense to me. But most importantly of all, the reason I'm going to vote yes on four and urge everyone else to, is that it takes away another tool, another club, so to speak, of the police, of the capitalist legal system, to just the excuse of pot to round up people, get them into the system, the criminal injustice system, and ruin their lives, use it as a form of control. It's no accident that they, with the whole stop and frisk thing, is a lot of it's based on just finding, small amounts of pot on people and knowing they're probably going to be able to do that statistically. If they target a large group of, say, African-American youth in a neighborhood or in an area of a city, that's their sort of go-to crime, quote-unquote, crime in quotes, is some sort of pot possession. And then, if someone, God forbid, doesn't like being molested by a cop over a few, a little bit of pot, and they like move the wrong way or justifiably take a shot, I don't mean a shot like a gunshot, but justifiably take a, throw back an elbow or something, leave me alone, cop, that something like that. Oh, all of a sudden it's resisting arrest and felony battery on a police officer and all that kind of stuff. It's just so easy to get enmeshed in the system with the entryway, the criminal injustice, with the entryway being a drug bust, a small pot drug bust. So get that weapon. They got too many weapons as it is. Get that weapon out of the hands of the cops. No more drug busts on marijuana. And I don't even think this law actually goes that far, but it's a step towards that. So despite I don't use pot, I don't find anything interesting about it. I don't know. I don't want to get into that whole personal moral stuff, but I'm totally separating that out. I'm totally like, and I have kids. I'm not interested in my kids ever smoking pot. Don't want them to ever smoke pot. But it's not the point. The point is that it's out there. People use it. So I have the same thing about alcohol. I'm going to try to get my kids not to ever drink, I don't drink. Don't drink, but it's out there in society, and the cops are going to use it, as they are now, as a way to hurt people. So more people are being hurt by having marijuana illegal than will be hurt, in my opinion, by having it legal. So I'm going to vote yes on 4, and we urge you to vote no on 2 to stop the encroachment of for-profit, ultimately for-profit education, privatization of education, and elite corporate welfare education, coming down through lifting the cap on charter schools. Cap the charter schools and get real funding from the federal government for public education. That's what has to happen. That's the fight. But no, the billionaires and millionaires aren't going to call for higher taxes on themselves and on their corporations. They're not going to even call for a cut in the military budget, because they use that military as a stick to promote capitalism and to get capitalism, get market share and so on, get their oil and so on internationally. I'm going to close out the show. Didn't get to much music. Apologize for that. We'll put something on towards the end. With a brilliant article, I really like it, by George Martin Fell Brown from socialistalternative.org. It's called A Contested Legacy, Ralph Nader's Challenge to the Two-Party System, published on November 3rd. And look under History Top Stories at socialistalternative.org. And the reason I want to spend time on this, and I have a lot of other good stuff, but we're not going to be able to get to it, is that, one of the main arguments that the liberals are using to try to get votes for their horrible candidate and horrible party, Democratic Party, and the Clinton regime, in part 2, now under Hillary instead of Bill, is to bring up so-called spoiled elections. And by the way, I have no problem spoiling an election of a corporate political... spoil the Republicans, spoil the Democratic elections. Who cares? But they're just lying about Ralph Nader. They're just lying about the 2000 election. And George brings together some good research and so on in this article, Contested Legacy, Ralph Nader's Challenge to the Two-Party System. I'm going to read bits of this. The specter of Ralph Nader has haunted the Democratic Party throughout the final months of the 2016 election. Worried that disaffected voters would be drawn to candidates like the Green Party's Jill Stein, Clinton's super PAC, Priorities USA Action, has launched a multimillion dollar campaign to warn people that a vote for a third party candidate is a vote for Donald Trump. Former President Al Gore has been enlisted as well in this effort to convince people that Ralph Nader's insurgent challenge for the presidency in 2000 spoiled, quote-unquote, Gore's campaign through the election of George Bush. Countless liberal think pieces have told and retold this cautionary tale as a warning to anyone who dares to try to build independent working-class politics. For Democratic Party apologists, Ralph Nader's campaign is a cautionary tale about the dangers of ideological purity. But Nader's presidential run in 2000 was the most successful left-wing independent presidential campaign in decades up to that point. While the tight election and massive campaign against him squeezed Nader's vote to only 3 million or 3% of the votes, his support and political impact was far greater. Even his other presidential runs in 96, 2004, and 2008, despite their smaller scale, provided activists with valuable training in independent politics. Nader's challenge to the two-party system does have important lessons for the left, and for people in general, I would add, just not the lessons the Democratic Party wants you to learn. And this is what I was referring to, and I'm not quoting, but this is what I was referring to earlier in the show, that if all the people that are ganging up on progressives, youth, et cetera, all the liberals that are ganging up and putting out this really bullying, mean-spirited, factually devoid arguments about voting for Clinton, the way they're doing that oftentimes is a way that completely wipes out any kind of critical thinking of capitalism, of the system, of even the electoral system, right? In other words, they're so into Hillary without understanding what that means fully, obviously, without even being able to quote a lot of things she stands for the most part, but even if they could, what they're doing is they're throwing up this huge, really quite conservative, I don't mean conservative in the way it's used in the corporate media, but quite conservative in terms of staying where you are as a people, as working people, staying where you are in terms of your consciousness, in terms of policy and so on, by supporting this corporate stalwart, this corporate pillar of business as usual, Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party. By supporting those so vociferously or even at all, even with your vote, I think it's wrong, very wrong, to vote corporate when you're a working person. That's very wrong. But even in terms of your arguments, I'm running into people that consider themselves progressive, even some that consider themselves left, that don't understand their arguments for Clinton are typical arguments in defense of the capitalist system, in defense of U.S. imperialism, in defense of all the injustices that at another time they might, if they consider themselves progressives, protest against even, or say it's wrong, you know? But all out for Hillary, all out for the Clinton dynasty, right? And this has an effect, right? Because if you are someone that takes the time to talk to other people, to talk on Facebook, to whatever, right? You're some sort of, however lame, however ill thought out, you're some sort of activist. I'll give you that. I'll give you, you're trying to convince people of something. I'll give you that, right? But you're doing it in a way that props up the system. You're doing it in a way that wrecks the thinking of so many youth and so many people that are starting to question. You're trying to pull people back into a system that is beyond defense. You're pulling people back into a worldview, all to get them to support Hillary, all to get them to do a certain vote in a way that will erase any gains made in their consciousness. Now, will that change in the future? Post-election, will somebody that you've convinced and bullied into voting for Clinton all of a sudden say, wait a minute, I'm still for a $15 minimum wage, even though Clinton isn't, or I'm still for, I don't think we should do that war in the Middle East. Certainly that will happen, but will it happen in as coherent a way? If you're not pointing out the structural problems with U.S. capitalism and with the corporate political parties, then people are just going to like jump from one, which they do. This is the way they're taught to think in schools and in the corporate, you know, education system and in the media and so on. They're taught to see the issues as disjointed, as not related. You know, capitalist exploitation here does not equal anything about a war in the Middle East, or capitalist exploitation here, you know, in terms of low wages and union busting and privatizing education, that's got nothing to do with what's happening in other countries or what's happening with my future or with the future of my children or so on. It's all just sort of separated out stuff, you know, and not linked by anything. You're doing a disservice. You're setting back any progress that's been made by, say, a movement like Occupy or a progressive left of the Democrats, so-called third party challenge like Stein Baraka, right? You know, you're setting back anti-war movements where people went out and tried to educate people about the nature of U.S. imperialism by defending Clinton, especially the way that most Clinton supporters defend Clinton, right? Is a step back for working class consciousness and for political consciousness for working people in this country. Mass consciousness, individual consciousness. You're basically throwing your lot in with the system. You're doubling down with the system. And the system is going to come out and under Clinton, and it's going to bite back hard. It is going to take all that support and use it to hurt the people, a lot of the people that supported Clinton, right? Because we're not talking about what she wants or some sort of individual wants and so on. We're talking about a system. We're talking about capitalism. And Clinton believes in capitalism. Clinton wants capitalism to exploit. I mean, there's these people fighting, Native Americans and others fighting these unnecessary pipelines over their land, pipeline going over their land. Clinton is for that, okay? You know, I mean, there's no, as we've said in other shows, when Trump gets on his ridiculous high horse about exploiting people's labor and being a rich piece of crap like he is, you know, does Clinton say, yeah, I don't like capitalism. I don't like rich, the rich have all this money in the poor. No. If you've heard some populist rhetoric from Clinton, but nothing that will strike at the heart of the system. So your defense of Clinton is defense of the system. And that's what's so insidious in a lot of this bullying and single-mindedness of the people on Facebook, people you might run into at work or at school or whatever, when they're defending Clinton. And a lot of them are unaware of it. They're like blissfully, oh yeah, Clinton, boom, check, you know, which is really, oh, unthinking check for capitalism, you know. It helps the system a lot. Now, are we going to hold a grudge? No. In Social Alternative, we understand the concrete material reasons for the duopoly, the corporate duopoly over U.S. politics. And anybody is welcome. Anybody is welcome to change their minds the day after the election. And you don't have the luxury in politics to say, I told you so. Because if we had that luxury, that's all I'd be saying, right? Every election, told you so. Every struggle where the union, you know, where the unions or working people didn't really struggle the right way or hard enough or whatever. I told you so with the outcome. You know, I told you so. I told you so. That's not politics for us. It's not a moralistic campaign. It is primarily what's the way forward. Primarily to take windows of opportunity, to use that cliche, and open them wider and get people to go through and to another level. You know, and it's arguable, you know, what that in this election cycle, what that means. You know, did most people take a step back in terms of their understanding system? Yeah, I think they did. But there's a few, there's a section, a layer of youth especially, but others who saw through the duopoly, saw through lesser evilism, stood up to the bullying, mostly by liberals, actually. Conservatives don't bother to talk to anybody about they think is a liberal or left or something. They don't understand what liberalism is, but whatever. Anyway, going back to George's article, Bill Clinton's American Nair campaign didn't come out of nowhere. It was the product of accumulated discontent at Bill Clinton's America, the two-party system, and international capitalism. After 8 years of Reagan and 4 years of Bush Sr., Clinton's New Democrats, quote-unquote, continued the same neoliberal policies when he took the White House in 1992. Clinton vigorously campaigned for and passed the North American Free Trade Agreement. This freed up more markets for U.S. corporations but provided little protection for workers' rights or the environment in Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. NAFTA and many other free trade policies Clinton pushed accelerated the flight of jobs to cheaper labor markets. Clinton ended welfare as we know it, passed the Anti-LGBTQ Defense of Marriage Act, and enacted destructive sanctions against Iraq. By the way, all these things were supported by Hillary, and this is just the tip of the iceberg. This is, you know, just setting up the context for where Nader came from. Now, I don't have time to get too into it, but Nader was a became disenchanted with the Carter administration, which is a whole other story too. The myths about Carter are legion, and yet Carter came back with a neoliberal agenda in his own right, trying to get big business profits back to where they were in the post-war upswing, and helping the corporations in numerous ways with tax breaks and so on. So Nader, among others, became disenchanted with Carter. The newly formed Green Party in 96 put Nader forward on the ballot, but he didn't really campaign, didn't get much of the vote. It wasn't what 2000 later became. And this was not the only attempt at building independent politics in the late 90s. 1996 also saw the launching of the U.S. Labor Party, full of lessons in its own right. Provoked by the passage of NAFTA, 10 labor unions declared their intent to form a new party. This is here in the United States. Most people don't know about this. I was intimately involved in this. Don't have time to go into it except to continue with this quote here. On a clear working-class basis, basing itself on 1 million, organizing 1 million members, the Labor Party had a much wider potential base of support than the Green Party or the 96 Nader campaign. Socialist Alternative played a leading role in several key Labor Party chapters and argued for it to run candidates at the local and national level. Now, Ralph Nader was a member of the Labor Party, not the Green Party, but the Labor Party leadership squandered the opportunity to build by blocking attempts to actually run candidates, which sounds odd for a political party, right? Including the opportunity to nominate Nader as their presidential candidate in 2000. So when a wave of discontent broke out and Nader decided to mount an energetic campaign for president, he accepted the Green Party's offer to put him on their ballot line in 2000. And it was the Green Party, not the Labor Party, that was catapulted into the spotlight. And part of that reason for that is in 1999, the World Trade Organization protests in Seattle, Teamsters and Turtles getting together and all that. And that kicked off the anti-globalization movement. The movement spread like wildfire across the globe. Mass demonstrations uniting workers, environmentalists, and radical youth. These popular movements targeted the major institutions of neoliberalism backed by the Democratic Republican parties alike. And anti-corporate ideas became more widespread. This is around 1999, 2000. The terrorist attacks 2001 cut across that movement, of course. Now, there was other mass movements at the time that came out of the globalization, anti-globalization movement. Don't have time to go into here. But NADER runs in 2000 as this is still happening. And against runs against Clinton's vice president, Al Gore. NADER refused all corporate donations, campaign on a program of single health care. Single-payer health care, living wage, repeal of anti-union laws, abolition of the death penalty. And although NADER was not or is not a socialist or even anti-capitalist, he took a strong stance against the influence of big business and politics. So he tapped into the ferment within the labor movement, for example, received some important union endorsements. Dozens of unions supported NADER. National unions, he had support of prominent civil rights leaders like Manning Marable and Cornel West. liberal personalities like Bill Murray, Susan Sarandon, Warren Beatty, Michael Moore, and others supported NADER. Again, this is a this is an independent presidential campaign. Popular musicians like Patti Smith, Eddie Vedder, Annie DeFranco, Joe Biafra, and Willie Nelson supported NADER. And despite a media blackout like Sanders, or even more so, NADER was found an audience. He had mass rallies, filled up stadiums. Where they charged $10 a piece and filled the stadiums. NADER drew 15,000 in Madison Square Garden, 14,000 in Minneapolis, 12,000 in Boston, 10,000 in Chicago. This is just to each one rally we're talking about, not a series of rallies. There were other rallies as well, 12,000 in Boston, etc. This was a mass movement. And the corporate media, and I'm not quoting George's article, I'm just quoting from memory, I'm just talking about my own memory at the time, really launched into NADER. They got scared by that support, and they really went after him. Right here in Boston, there was some of this history was made where NADER tried to go to the debates, despite he had enough support. A student gave him a ticket to at least go into it, and the police refused, despite a 5,000 protest rally. I was there. I remember that. Very high energy. Police on horseback charged a crowd, beat protesters, attacked them with pepper spray. I was not hurt at that, but I saw people that were, and it was all to stop free speech, basically, here in America. Socialist Alternative was heavily involved in the NADER campaign. We mobilized the RNC. We mobilized to the RNC and DNC protests, as well as the super rallies. We mobilized our own members and supporters. In Boston, we helped organize the 5,000-strong presidential debate protest at UMass. We held public debates with Gore supporters in college campuses around the country and used the NADER campaign to boost other local struggles for immigrant rights and living wage. Our Minneapolis branch was built out of the NADER, supporting the NADER campaign. We initiated the Seattle NADER Coalition, which built the NADER campaign in the neighborhoods of Seattle and held weekly activities. And it was a social alternative member who moved the resolution to get Teamsters Local 174 in Seattle to endorse NADER. But we also use the campaign to strengthen movements and talk about the need for a left-wing alternative to Democrats in terms of a party, which NADER was not really talking about or wouldn't do anything to help. Getting into Florida and the whole crux of the propaganda and lies about the NADER campaign, him being a spoiler and so on, this narrative is repeated like a mantra among Democratic Party liberals, but it's a one-sided myth. It's a story told to suppress dissent rather than to genuinely learn from our history. Of course, it is mathematically true that according to the sharply disputed official vote count, Bush beat Gore in Florida by 537 votes and NADER won 97,488 votes in the same state. Had those NADER votes gone to Gore, instead, the Florida vote would have flipped, and given the peculiarities of the Electoral College, Gore would have won the White House. But this is only one side of the question. Even Bill Scheer, while chastising advocates of independent politics for their refusal to accept mathematical rally, is forced to admit, quote, lots of factors can be blamed for such a paper-thin defeat, unquote, and the NADER vote is only one of those. He simply chooses to place all the blame on NADER because it's politically expedient. The fact is, Al Gore won the popular vote in 2000, but it's only because of the undemocratic nature of the Electoral College that Bush could win overall while losing the popular vote. Even if we accept the legitimacy of the Electoral College and focus exclusively on the Florida vote, the 97,480 voters were dwarfed by the 308,000 registered Democrats in Florida who voted for Bush. So if you're going to try to use NADER as an example of don't be a spoiler, then you're just ignoring the 308,000, many, many more votes that are registered Democrats that voted for Bush. So what are you going to call that? Democratic Party loyalty? Democratic Party can't organize people? Democratic Party isn't attractive enough to even its own voters, etc. It's got nothing to do with spoiling. Although, again, I don't care. Spoil. But that's just not the reality. The reality is there were only 97,488 Nader voters in Florida in 2000, but there were 308,000 registered Democrats in Florida who voted for Bush. That's where, if you want to look at why that changed, either look to that or look to what I already read from George's article about the electoral system trumping the popular vote, no pun intended. Now, a little more about that, about the details. Even then, this ignores the fact that the Florida vote was marred by voter suppression during a contentious recount. Amidst controversy about hanging chads and butterfly ballots was the direct suppression of thousands of voters, primarily in the African-American community, who were illegally blocked from voting because their name happened to match that of a convicted felon. More in George's article about voter suppression. And also this theft of the election by the Republicans was sanctified by the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision, but also by the Democratic Party leadership to accept the decision of Gore, for the good of the country. You know, you can hear those backroom discussions now, because that was dragging on, and of course that would start to make people question the legitimacy of the system a little more, and you just see them saying to Gore, look, you're being vice president, we'll take care of you. You know, you being president is not equal to people losing faith, quote unquote, in this rotten system. So let's just go with what we got here. And so there was, instead of the Democrats, you know, trying to really fight this, instead of Gore trying to really fight it, they decided to just blame Nader for Bush's victory. This had short-term effects that people probably don't remember. There was heavy criticism of the Supreme Court. There were people protesting, but not enough because the Democrats didn't organize mass protests, basically. Then when Bush gets in there, right, the Democrats in Congress colluded with Bush in terms of voting and so on to pass a lot of the stuff that Bush is blamed for. And this is not an apologetic for Bush. Bush was horrible, but that's not the point right now. A majority of Democratic senators voted for the war in Iraq, including Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, and Gore's former running mate, Joe Lieberman. No Child Left Behind, Bush's notorious crackdown on public education, faced stronger opposition from the Republicans than the Democrats. And unlike the Democratic Party leaders, Nader voters actually took to the streets to fight these attacks. And then the article gets into why didn't Nader go for building a political party. Very important stuff. Very, very important. The international ramifications of that and so on. Then gets into what we did, but the Green Party and some of its weaknesses, very, very important. And also 2004, that election, more lesser evilism, and Nader not in the same position, and yet more on that. So again, ran out of time here on this article, but I highly recommend it. It's from socialistalternative.org, author George Martin Fell Brown. November 3rd, 2016. And the rest of the article, the part that I'm skimming over, has some really real gold in it, you know, of, for example, attitude. Like, there was a reporter in Seattle writing for alternative newspaper who exoriated Socialist Alternative for supporting Nader. And yet when Sharma ran as an independent, as a socialist and so on, supported that. So it shows how people can change, how a lot of people that the liberals are afraid will become right wing or something by not automatically voting for Clinton, which, you know, whose policies are different in some ways, but there's too many similarities there between the Republican and Democratic parties and between Trump and Clinton on a certain level, basic economics, basic foreign policy and so on, actually, that's how the right gains ground in this country, when there's no viable left alternative. Some people are not going to sit there and starve quietly or see their living standards go down the tubes quietly. They're going to look for solutions, even crazy ones like Trump or Clinton. And therefore, without a left building an alternative and on the ascendancy, giving concrete opportunities to people for things like free education or free healthcare that people will support once you get through the noise with going door to door and so on, really talking to people, you can overcome that inherent bias in the corporate media. We prove that in Seattle, can prove that in other places. Out of time. Vote Stein Baraka, please. Vote no on 2. Vote yes on 4 if you're here in Massachusetts. 2 is to stop the charter schools from encroaching into education more and using up resources and so on, and yes on 4 is to take to take steps towards legalization of marijuana, so it can't be used as a tool to repress people anymore, the laws against marijuana. So thanks for listening. Sorry for that rush towards the end there, but happens every show because there's so much to talk about. You have been listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talking music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. Check us out on Facebook at Socialist Alternative Radio. Go to socialistalternative.org. Don't just get the alternative information we're giving you. Join us. Get involved. Fight back. Voting is important, but not the way they're saying. Vote for a step forward for independent politics for working people in this country. Vote Stein Baraka in this particular election. Vote.